Well, welcome back to another hour of Coast to Coast AM, where we're talking real science, the particle at the end of the universe. Dr. Sean Carroll, our guest, and your phone calls all next on Coast to Coast AM. Sean, do you believe the universe has order to it?
Yeah, I think that there is order. There's certainly, for example, a continuity from moment to moment with the same kinds of particles, roughly speaking, obeying what we think are the laws of physics.
How did it get there? How did the law of physics get applied?
I don't know. It might just be that that's just the way it is, that what we call a law uses the word in English that is the same as we use when there's a legislature that passes a regulation. But the universe doesn't have a legislature like that. This is just a sloppy use of the English language. It could just be there. There could be a deeper reason for it. We should be open-minded about that.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Laura in Philadelphia. Hi, Laura. Thanks for holding so long. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Good morning, and good morning, Sean. George, if I just may say to you very quickly, when I discovered Coast to Coast about 6 years ago, the first show, you were talking about shadow people, and I said to myself, I'm not listening ever again. But lo and behold, I hung on for this many years, and I have to tell you, I think you are a man for all seasons. You are a Renaissance man, and you deserve all the kudos that you get.
Well, thank you, Laura.
Having said that, Sean, I'd like to use a typical Twilight Zone episode to present my question. The astronaut goes into space, travels a certain amount of time at a certain speed. He's 30 years old. He leaves a 30-year-old wife behind, and he comes back X amount of time later, and she's 80 years old. Given that we have charted the speed of light, we have charted the speed of sound, how are we so sure, in relation to that example that I just gave you, that we know the speed of time, given that we ourselves have charted the speed of time, if my question makes any sense to you? And this is a sort of little itch that's been bothering me ever since I saw a Twilight Zone episode like that.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting thing to talk about. I do talk about this a lot in my previous book, From Eternity to Here, which is about how time works. And it's actually something we understand a lot about. This Twilight Zone episode uses the idea from relativity that if one person stays stationary here on Earth and someone else zips out at the speed of light and then zips back, the person who went on the trip will have experienced much less time than the person who stayed back here on Earth. And that's not restricted to the Twilight Zone or to TV. That's something we know is true based on experiments here on Earth. We send particles, not human beings, but individual particles, very, very close to the speed of light. And, for example, we send particles that can decay, that have a lifetime. You know, they last for about 1 second before they decay. And we zoom them to the speed of light, or very, very close to it, and suddenly they last for a lot longer than 1 second, because their experience of time is different than ours. And that's something we utterly understand. That was also the subject of my technical book, Space, Time, and Geometry, how relativity teaches us about this. So time is something whose behavior is something that, you know, in the everyday world or the world of rocket ships and experiments here on Earth, we have a theory that fits the data very, very well. It's counterintuitive, it surprises us, but it is within the realm of our understanding.
Thank you very much. I think I'll stay away from the Twilight Zone episode. Thank you very much, Joe.
Thanks,
good
Laura.
Morning.
Okay, I appreciate that. You have fun doing this, Sean, I can tell.
Absolutely. What could be more fun than figuring out how the world works?
Tell me about the students over the years. What are they looking for? What do they want to learn?
You know, in the particular field I'm in, almost inevitably, the students are kind of idealistic, right? They're not in it for the money. There's a lot of ways to make a lot more fame or glory or money for a smart person than studying theoretical physics, let's put it that way. They want to know the answers. They're driven to do the hard work of learning these difficult theories, mastering what has come before them, and trying to contribute a little bit in their own way to moving past that. They're all different. This is a great thing about science, is that there's no right technique for doing it. People have their own individual styles, and you never know what's going to pay off. And they're just relentlessly curious, which is what drove them here in the first place. And it's always a pleasure to be challenged by the students who are coming up young and hungry behind you.
So you're bullish on the future here.
Very much, yeah. No, I mean, there's just so many talented, bright people working hard, figuring things out. The data is coming in. We live in a really good time to be thinking about how the universe works.
Let's go next to Griffin in Pasco, Washington. Griffin, go ahead.
Hi, George. I've got a couple of quick questions for you guys this morning, the first of which stems from a book that I read by Michio Kaku a ways back, and he dipped on the idea of how our three physical dimensions move and interact inside of the fourth, fifth, and sixth, and so on. And I'm having a lot of trouble visualizing that as far as how our physical matter or waves or, you know, particles react to another physical dimension around and through us. Also, the idea of gravity, I know, I mean, as a weak force and as much as anybody else does, but when it's described as, or the way that it was described to me is as like the fifth dimension sort of folding in upon itself to create force in between, you know, atoms of different masses. Just wondering if you could paint a little bit of a clearer picture for me, and I'll take my answers off the air.
All right. Thanks, Griffin. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that that last bit it does not sound quite right to me. Gravity, as we currently understand it from Einstein, is the curvature of space-time itself. And mathematically, we have no trouble describing that. You know, once you go through years of education in mathematics, then you have no trouble describing it. We know what to do. But picturing it is very hard. As you walk through a room, you don't think of the space around you as something that has curvature or a geometry. It's just a little bit of an alien concept. So we draw pictures, right? Or we make visual representations to try to get across what's going on. And inevitably, we draw or represent curved two-dimensional surfaces embedded in this three-dimensional space that's around us. So people get the idea that space is sort of curling into a new dimension that we don't see, but that's misleading. That's just an artifact of our attempts to make it more visual. The reality is that as far as we know, from experience, from experiment, from observation, there are three dimensions of space, one dimension of time, and that's all you need. Now, there are theories that are very popular and promising theories that say that there are additional dimensions, but they're very, very small. They're curled up into a tiny little ball so that we can't see them. And the way in which those dimensions are curled up and hidden can affect the particle physics we know and love, the mass and the charge and the interactions of different kinds of particles. That's a speculative but very interesting and promising idea, but it's not something that's established right now.
All right, thank you for that. Gabriel in Orlando, Florida, he's been on hold for a while. Hi, Gabe, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. It's a fascinating show tonight.
Thank you.
My question is, I was very curious about how the Large Hadron Collider would have compared to the canceled superconducting super collider, and I'd like to know what you think the future of experimental physics will be in this country. Will we have any more mega-scale projects like the canceled SSC, or is this strictly going to be results of international collaboration due to the incredible expense required for these projects?
Yeah, these are fantastic questions that go right to the heart of the future of particle physics. Here in the United States, we had a project, the Superconducting Super Collider. It started in the 1980s, and it was killed in the 1990s by Congress about the same time as the Large Hadron Collider in Europe really got going. And the U.S. project would have been bigger and better. It was more expensive. It was higher energy. It was a very impressive machine. And eventually we decided we couldn't afford it. So we, you know, sold it off. And now it's sort of lying there in Texas as a big empty hole. What's going to happen in the future? It's very hard to tell. I would be very surprised if any one country decided that they just were going to do it themselves in terms of the next big particle accelerator. It's just something that seems too big a task in the modern world for any one country to do. Now, the Japanese are very interested in the possibility of hosting a collider because they're trying to recover from the tsunami that they suffered not too long ago, and it's a good way to sort of move forward in reconstructing your infrastructure, to have a big project like that. But they would need a lot of help from other countries in the world if they were to do it at all. And there's still the possibility that nobody will do it. You know, it's expensive. There are other interests, other concerns that people in the world have. It, you know, budgets are tight. So in the sad future scenario, the Large Hadron Collider is the last major particle accelerator ever built. I really hope that that's not the case, but it's a real possibility that we need to consider.
I think so, too. Toronto, Canada, Chris, your turn on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Chris.
Hi there. I'm glad you're getting into relativity now. I have a couple of questions for you. Just two things. The first being, I look online and I find a couple of engines that look like they could actually make gravity as an engine, and some of them make sense. I wanted to ask you about this one. You know how the faster you go, the more energy you have to expend because you become more massive, so you don't reach the speed of light?
Yes.
What if you put a ferrofluid in a torus and wrap a coil around that? The electricity would spin it around, and with an additional apparatus using a same side-facing magnets and circles, you could give it additional speed. You could control how fast it goes and thus how heavy it gets, I guess. You can make gravity, right?
Well, that's right. You know, Einstein taught us, among many things that Einstein taught us, E equals mc squared. So what that means is that if you have an object at rest, its mass is basically equal to the amount of energy it has. It's mass times the speed of light squared. So if you take an object and you put more energy in it by heating it up, by spinning it, by putting electrical fields in there, or various ways of putting more energy in, it will weigh more, it will have more mass, and therefore will create more gravity. Now, if you actually take the numbers seriously, this is a horrifically inefficient way of making gravity. You have to get that energy from somewhere, and the amount of energy you need to make even a little bit of mass is a tremendous amount, because if E equals mc squared, then m is E divided by c squared. So to get any mass at all, you need a huge amount of energy since the speed of light is such a big number. So I don't think it's a practical consideration, to be honest. I think that it's something you can imagine doing, but if you want gravity, just get a big hunk of stuff, and that'll give you gravity.
How close is Hollywood to real-life physics when they come out with their movies and, you know, their warp speed shows and things like that?
Well, it depends a lot, actually, on the specifics. You know, Hollywood is not in the business of science education. That's not why they're there. They're in the business of selling tickets and entertaining you. So sometimes the way to do that is to throw the laws of physics away. And, you know, just the idea of traveling faster than the speed of light violates the laws of physics, but much of science fiction would be possible without it. Then in other circumstances, you want a movie or a TV show that is as realistic as you can get it because it adds to the verisimilitude. And there they try to do a relatively good job. And believe it or not, The Big Bang Theory, the sitcom that is one of the highest rated TV shows on television, gets the science completely correct. They have a paid science advisor who is a professor of physics at UCLA, and every little equation that you see on the whiteboards and every little bit of technobabble they're trading back and forth,
it's
that
all
is vetted
real
for scientific accuracy.
Sure is. Let's go next to Vince in Cupertino, California. Hey, Vince, go ahead.
Hey, guys. Great show tonight. Thank you. My question is, you know, as far as how accepted something like a theory of evolution is to describe, you know, in this society, where does string theory and M theory fit as far as a description of the universe and the leading theories? And if they're not, where is the data point to as far as a theory that is considered kind of the evolution acceptedness of, you know, the laws of physics in the universe?
And explain string theory again for us.
Right, in 2 seconds, yes. String theory is actually easy to explain. It's the idea that what you think of as particles, electrons, quarks, neutrinos, whatever, are really little loops or segments of vibrating string. And if you ask string of what, you're not allowed to ask that. It's the stuff that strings are made out of. That's the fundamental stuff of reality. And all the particles we see are different ways that these strings can move and vibrate. And this simple sounding idea, so you take that idea, you write down some equations to try to describe how the strings vibrate, and you get out a tremendous amount, including a prediction that there should be something called gravity. Now, unfortunately for string theory, this prediction was made long after gravity was discovered, so it doesn't really count as a brand new prediction. But it's very encouraging that we have a theory that automatically gives you gravity whether you like it or not, because we know that there is gravity in the world. Now, to the caller's question, though, there is no data that indicate that string theory is on the right track, other than the fact that there is gravity and there are other ways in which the world looks very compatible with string theory, but these were all ways that were already there before we invented string theory. So the fair analysis of the situation is that right now string theory is certainly the most promising way we have of trying to get at that question I mentioned earlier of reconciling quantum mechanics and gravity, unifying quantum gravity in a single theory. String theory is a leading candidate, but it has not yet succeeded in making predictions for the real world that we can go out there and measure and then figure out whether it's right or not. So that doesn't mean that it's right or wrong. It means that it's nowhere near the status of something like natural selection, Darwinian evolution, where we have predictions that have come true. We have plenty of data that shows that it's there. Right now, string theory is still very much a speculation.
Peter Higgs, who is he? They named the particle after him.
They did, and that's a source of controversy, the fact that they named the particle after him, because, in fact, there's at least seven different physicists who wrote papers in 1963 and 64 suggesting very similar ideas to each other, and Higgs was one of them. But he wasn't the first or the last. He was the first to specifically mention that there would be a new particle that this idea predicts. Remember that the important thing about the Higgs idea is this field that spreads throughout the universe. And that was the idea that all these different physicists were talking about. But there's Philip Anderson, Robert Brout, Francois Englert, there's people named Guralnik, Hagen, and Kibble. They all came up with this idea. Higgs himself is 83 years old now. He has worked in Edinburgh in Scotland for most of his professional career. He's a very unassuming, nice man. He is very, very pleased that the idea that he helped pioneer has become such a big deal. It's very likely that somebody is going to win a Nobel Prize for this idea very soon, but we don't know who, because the Nobel Prize, as a tradition, only three or fewer people can win it in any one year. And in that case, it's very unclear who it might go to.
John, we're going to come back and take final phone calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Gary David joins us. We're going to be talking about artifacts, Hopi prophecy. Make sure you're part of that show. When we come back in just a moment with Sean Carroll, The Particle at the End of the Universe, let's take final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. More calls here for Sean Carroll, The Particle at the End of the Universe. How long will they run, CERN? Sean, how long will the Large Hadron Collider go?
It depends, but quite a while. In fact, they're going to shut down early next year to sort of take the machine apart and upgrade it, and then start again in 2015 with a much higher energy. And then they'll probably go for 20 years at least, and depending on, you know, how the funding and situation goes and so forth, they might upgrade it once again sometime down the road.
Some people think there's some kind of secret government project going on down there.
Yeah, you know, we have enough in our hands are full doing particle physics. I think that if you were going to have a secret government project, you would put it very far away from a bunch of scientists with not a lot of respect for authority, let's put it that way.
They're trying to drill down to the core, aren't they, to keep it from stopping or something?
Well, they got 300 feet down, so they're pretty far away from the core.
Mike is in Louisville, Kentucky. Hey, Mike, go ahead.
Hey, George. I got to tell you, this is a terrific show for a retired baby boomer physics teacher.
Oh, my gosh. Perfect.
Of course, my interest did not end with my retirement. In fact, I think I'm into it more than ever before now.
It became your hobby.
Exactly. My question for Sean is a little unusual, probably, because it mixes physics with medicine. However, I'm interested to know that if he thinks that this research could lead to even smaller nanoparticles that could attack not only cancer cells, but also the very, very tiniest invaders we have, the viruses. If that could be, you know, this research could lead, it's fascinating stuff. I'm just wondering if he thinks this research could lead to some type of implications in medicine. And I'll sign off and take my answer off the air.
Okay, Mike, thank you. What do you think of that, Sean?
Well, it's interesting. There certainly have been applications of particle accelerator technology to medicine. I don't think that the Higgs boson research in particular is going to be relevant to medicine because it's at such high energies. I mean, you need a 17-mile-long particle accelerator to achieve what we're doing here, and that's just not a feasible medical strategy. You can do things much easier with much smaller devices. So I think the general field of particle physics has been very helpful to medicine, including if you want to go way back in discovering things like X-rays. But I don't think that the Large Hadron Collider research in particular is going to do that. I could be surprised, but that's not my guess.
Sir Isaac Newton, are his theories still strong today?
Well, they're good enough to, for instance, fly to the moon, which is pretty good. You don't need to know general relativity to get a rocket from here to the moon or back. So I think that what Newton did was get something right, but we now have instruments, have observations that are so precise, we can detect effects that are so subtle that Newton didn't know about them. And so therefore we need a better theory than Newton came up with, and Einstein gave us that theory. So Newton is still, in my mind, the greatest physicist of all time. We now know that his theories have been superseded, but they're still very accurate in the regime where we apply them. To play baseball, you don't need to know quantum mechanics or relativity. You just need to know Newtonian physics.
James in Asheville, North Carolina. James, go ahead.
Hi, excellent show. I'm just going to throw out a couple of questions for you.
Sure.
A few months ago, there was a story that came out over the news media from Switzerland that they had broken the light barrier. And then they didn't. Was there an instrument malfunction? The story went away real quick.
Yes.
But I want your comment on that. Also, you talk about dark matter. You know, we know it's there. We can't prove it, but we know it's there. Antimatter is not science fiction. We know it's there. From what I understand, it's very difficult to produce, but do you consider there to be a possibility of an energy source there?
Yeah, these are both very good questions. There was a news story in 2011, last year, where scientists starting at CERN, the same place where the Large Hadron Collider is located, they made neutrinos, and they shot them underneath the Earth to a laboratory in Italy where they were detected. And the result was that it seemed that the neutrinos were traveling faster than the speed of light. And roughly speaking, nobody believed them because this is a very difficult measurement to do, and it would truly overthrow a lot of how we think about particle physics if that were right. And it would have been very fun. It would have been great if it were true. So we wanted to believe it, but we were skeptical, and eventually they figured out that indeed there was a loose cable, basically, and their timing apparatus was miscalibrated, and they were just wrong. So that went away.
It's too bad.
Nothing left about that, yeah. And, sorry, what was the other one?
Antimatter.
Yeah, antimatter we make all the time. It's very easy to make, but it's not a great energy source because it requires a lot of energy to make it. If you want a good energy source, you want energy that's already out there that you can collect. If we had better technology, antimatter might make a good energy storage device. If you collect energy from
the sun, for example, use it to make antimatter and then carry that antimatter around with you so you can later release the energy contained in it. But that's right now a science fiction scenario. We don't nearly have good enough technology to pull that off.
Sean, do you think if we went into a black hole, we'd be torn to bits?
I'm pretty sure that if we went into a black hole, we'd be torn to bits. I'm not completely sure because nobody's ever done it. And if anyone ever did do it, they wouldn't be able to report back. But our best theories right now certainly say that that is true. So I don't think anyone's going to be volunteering anytime soon.
I wonder if we could send a probe into a wormhole. Is there one close enough to do that?
Actually, wormholes, as far as we know, don't exist. A black hole is a firm prediction of general relativity. It's what happens when a star collapses and the gravitational field is so strong that nothing can escape. And that's something we see. In the sky, we see examples of what really look like black holes. The center of our galaxy has a black hole about 4 million times the mass of the sun. But a wormhole is something where you would go in and then be spat out somewhere else in the universe. And theorists like me can write down scenarios about what that would be like, but there's no evidence at all that they really exist in nature.
Vancouver, Washington, Ryan, west of the Rockies.
Yeah, Ryan. I was just wondering if you could cook antimatter for Thanksgiving. I'm just joking. No, I'll keep this brief. I just heard the last half an hour of the show. What's the difference between quantum physics and particle physics? I never quite understood that because my brain works so fast, but I'll take the answer off the air. You guys have a good night, okay?
Okay, Ryan, thank you for calling. Go ahead, Sean.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. Particle physics is basically an application of quantum mechanics or quantum physics. Quantum mechanics is a way of thinking. It's what has replaced classical mechanics. Classical mechanics was Isaac Newton's great gift to the world, the idea that, you know, every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, for example. That's an example of classical mechanics. And then quantum mechanics comes along in the early 20th century and says, you know, there's not even such a thing as positions and velocities. There are wave functions that tell you the probability of getting different answers. And that's a very general way of thinking about how the world works. And particle physics is what you get when you apply that idea of quantum mechanics, put it in the context of relativity, which Einstein gave us, and you invent quantum field theory, which we talked about at the very beginning of the show. And when you look at the fields, like the electromagnetic field, you see particles. You see photons when you look at the electromagnetic field, gravitons when you look at the gravitational field. So particle physics is relativity plus quantum mechanics.
All right, a few more calls here. Let's go to Don in Ohio. Hey, Don, thanks for calling. Go ahead. You with us?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead, Donnie.
I was just wondering, there was some tests back in the early 60s, late 50s, I guess, at Stanford, and that accelerator called a gold foil test. And it led to some breakthroughs because of ionization. It led to some breakthroughs in physics that they was able to develop a lot of the space stuff with, the space rockets, and they went to the moon on. I was just wondering, is any of his research right now dealing with any of that?
Sean?
Not really, to be honest. You know, laboratories in physics have interesting life cycles. You know, they're planned for a purpose, and then 20 years later, that purpose is fulfilled, and they do something else. For example, the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, SLAC, as it's known, was a particle accelerator. It won multiple Nobel Prizes for the work that was done there, and now it's done. So they turned off the particle accelerator, and they now use it as to make high-intensity X-rays, and which are used to study chemistry and biology. So my work is mostly concerned with high-energy particle physics and cosmology. So the frontiers there now are at CERN, at the Large Hadron Collider, and also at various telescopes and satellites around the world that are telling us more about the universe.
Next up, Toronto, Canada, Fausto, it's your turn. Hi, Fausto.
Hi, George Norrie. I'm a longtime listener from 1999, listening to you live on AM 640 and 510 CKTV.
Super. Thank you.
Now, Mr. Master Physicist, I would like to know your future forecast with respect to the water contamination that continues to be polluted and poisoned, landing on the west coast of North America, I guess around Cali, between Cali and Japan. What say you with regards to fish, water, eating any fish? What's going to happen to the East Coast? Anything in between time and in between time?
Yeah, you know, I think these are great questions, which you should not ask me about, to be honest. I mean,
the physicist might not have that answer, right?
I don't. Yeah, you could ask random people on the street and get just as much educated responses as you could me. I'm very much aware of and concerned about the damage we are doing to the earth, the atmosphere, the oceans, et cetera. It's very real, and I know the experts are very concerned, and I think we should listen to them.
Is there any downside of physics here, Sean? Can anything go happen? Not in the universe, as I asked you last time, but can anything happen on this planet because of physics, because they tinker around too much?
You know, because physics works with nature at a very fundamental level, and because physics was deeply involved with nuclear power and the atomic bomb and so forth, physicists have become incredibly good at being careful. You know, every time there's a new particle accelerator or a new experiment or something like that, there are multiple studies done about how safe it is and, you know, whether it's a good idea and so forth. And you're never perfect. Of course, there can always be accidents. But these days, the accidents, the really bad things, are much more likely to come from biology, medicine, pathology than they are from physics.
Charles, Salem, Oregon. Hey, Charles, go ahead, sir.
Yes, this is Charles. I'm listening on KEX.
Ah, great. Thank you.
And I'm curious, have you ever considered a gravitational field to be a time rate gradient structure?
Well, not really. You know, I think that, again, we have a very good theory, general relativity, given by Einstein, that explains how gravity works in the part of the universe we can easily observe. There's plenty of reason to believe that general relativity is not the final word. There's more that we need to know. But right now, you know, we're trying our best to find some observable place in the universe where general relativity isn't good enough, and we haven't found it yet. So, and I wrote a whole textbook, Space, Time, and Geometry, about how general relativity works. But I would love to write an updated edition because we found something even better. So far, that hasn't happened.
All right. Thank you. Lexington, Kentucky. James, it's your turn, James. Hi there.
Oh, thank you. Sean, I got an idea I'd like to throw at you and have your opinion. I'm not educated, so this may be in quantum physics already, or it may be just crazy. But anyway, my idea would explain how the universe, why it's symmetrical and why some of the weird things of quantum physics, like quantum locality, work. Okay. What would explain it is the small particles aren't part of time. Somehow they're void of time or not in the time dimension or whatever you want to call it. Okay, if that, you know, that would explain why quantum non-locality works. Okay, so if if that's possible, then there's nothing to say that all the matter in the universe isn't made of one tiny little particle. Because if it's not part of time, it can be everywhere at once or you know, at any given time. So, and that would explain the symmetry of the universe, because this particle would be, you know, everywhere. So what do you think about that?
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting. I think that it's very, very hard, you know, just to be very honest with you, it's very hard to come up with a new theory like that from scratch, because there is so much that we do know about the universe. And, you know, we have theories that explain quantum entanglement and the symmetry of the universe that are different. And, you know, it's a little bit of a downer when I say this, but I always tell people, you know, if you want to move beyond our present best theories of the universe, then you're not going to convince anyone to take you seriously unless you first learn and master the theories we already have. And so I love it when people are trying to come up with theories to think beyond what we already know, because that's what I do for a living, and I love it myself. But we do know a lot, and fitting in with all that we already know is the real challenge here. So if I were you, you know, buy some physics books, learn what we already know, see if you can fit in your ideas to the constraints that the data are already giving us.
All right, let's take, we may not have time for any more calls. It's going fast. Let's see if we can get Joshua in and Macon, Georgia. Josh, real fast, go ahead.
Yes, hello. I've got a quick question.
Sure.
What if that you have an object in time, not in time, but in our dimension, right? And it exists within our dimension, but it also exists within multiple dimensions. And when I speak of dimensions, I'm speaking of like other realms of sorts. And technically, if that object exists in the same space, here and in other dimensions, wouldn't that mean it's occupying the same space as like another
dimension? All right,
we're
going to have 20 seconds to respond, Sean. That's all we got.
Yeah, you know, when physicists use the word dimension, they mean a direction, not a place. So we don't think there's any other places in the universe where particles are. We think we have a description of the world that works all at once.
Sean, I want to thank you for being on the program, my friend. Sean Carroll, The Particle at the End of the Universe. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, George Knapp, John B. Wells, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everybody.